focusing on a loop. Let's just talk about the quarter wave ground plane. If I heard you correctly, you saw what appeared to be 20 decibels of performance change when you change the diameter of the radiator, with or without taper, and the tuning. You change tuning and diameter of quarter wave radiator, and it was in the vicinity of 6 1/2 inches long at 449 megacycles, 6 1/4 or so inches long. You saw apparently 20 decibels of change in performance. Or, another way you worded it later on, you had to change the single generator by 3 dB to come back to the same reading. So, from another point of view, you saw 3 decibels of change in performance. Am I misquoting you when I say those words, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW?
No, you're not misquoting me, Dick. I think what's happening is that we're talking about a couple of different things at different times. I'm just saying that the least amount of change was definitely on a loop. The second amount of change where of criticalness to construction was the half-wave dipole. The antenna where I saw 20 dB microvolt of difference, which was approximately, I don't know, I think I had to adjust the generator almost 10 dB, I think, of difference from the time that I started to get the same reading at the end, was a mixture of changing the thickness of the radiating element itself, which was maybe 2 to 3, maybe not even quite. You know, you could make the argument there that the thickness might have been a little bit more than a dB of change on the generator to get the same reading again, but I'll tell you what really was critical was that bushing mount between the, let's say, the center conductor to that plate, and how well, you know, you connect the, you know, that radiating element to the plate and how it's spaced, because that seemed to be where it was extremely critical. And what was happening was I had to go back and forth quite a few times with the radiating element itself. You know, yes, I would definitely see an improvement with, you know, using the thickest and fattest diameter material in there at 449, but the changing that bushing height and adjusting it again a couple of times, and each time I had a 50 ohm match from the beginning to the end. It wasn't like the match was changing, it was just the bushing height and then the length of the radiator were getting adjusted every time I screwed around with the bushing. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm reasonably sure, Glenn, that an error is taking place here. I know what you saw on the instrumentation, and I believe you. But the interpretation of it is a problem. If I take a quarter wave of high conductivity materials, I presume your radiators were either pieces of aluminum or pieces of copper or copper tape. I hope none of the radiators were stainless steel. I've run into some nasty characteristics of stainless steel when mixed with the 400 megacycle antennas. So, assuming you never use stainless steel, which happens to be a material with resistivity that is not very far away from nichrome, and nichrome is used as a resistive material. You make power resistors out of nichrome. So stainless steel is not very far from it in resistivity. Pretty yucky material. So assuming you were using real conductors, copper or aluminum, to get even a tenth of a decibel of change in performance out of an antenna, while it still gives you nearly 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, is very difficult. You didn't change the size of the ground plane. You only change what appeared to be the coupling into a G-TEM, which really is coupling into that metal plate that goes down the center of the G-TEM that makes it a 50-ohm wide strip line, if you know what I mean. It really is a great big piece of strip line. That's what the G-TEM is, with a termination at the far end. And it's made to generate a known E-field for a device on the test. It's not intended to be an antenna range. A smart person may get some antenna range performance out of it, but it's really not intended for that, and I think this could have been giving you some erroneous readings here, because 20 decibels is huge. A decibel of change on a quarter wave ground plane, to me, is huge. By the laws of conservation of energy, if I put a watt of power into your antenna and viewed it with a thermal imaging camera, unless you use nichrome or stainless steel, I know everything there is going to run ice cold. I know that you're using low-loss materials that are not eating up the power. I know that you had a reasonably low standing wave ratio. So every watt you put into that transmission line is being radiated by that antenna. So if 98% of the power is always being radiated by the antenna, obvious by a thermal imaging test you could do, and by the Vizwar test you did do, you know it's not being reflected. The only way you can change the gain of the antenna is to change its antenna pattern and three-dimensional space. When you've got a 6.25-inch radiator and you change it to 6 inches or 6.5 inches, and you change it from a 22-gauge piece of wire to a 4-gauge piece of wire, you change the diameter of the radiating element. You didn't change the electronic real estate that changes the pattern in three-dimensional space. You use the exact same size of ground plane, the exact same length to the nearest 0.05 wavelength of radiator. The diameter of the radiator per se does not change the pattern. You didn't do anything to change the pattern. Therefore, you didn't change the real gain. You're not eating up any power. Therefore, you're not changing the efficiency of radiation. You didn't have any bad Vizwar, so you weren't reflecting any energy. So if I take everything I know about conservation of energy and the watt of power you could have put into that antenna, you can't make even 0.2 dB of change of the apparent gain in free space. You may have seen lots of dBs of change in the GTEM. I think there's a moderately high probability here, Glenn, that GTEM was fibbing to you, because it's not intended for this kind of a test. You see where I'm coming from here, from my point of view on conservation of energy. And I'm not attacking you. I'm attacking the physics here that you are being subjected to. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I think what you're seeing is the effect of doubling or whatever, increasing the illumination area. And the 20 dB is really not 20 dB, but some other number. But increasing the illumination area will get him more radiation. That's a definite.
Yeah.
Just KTKY, then get back to me, Dick. I'll tell you about a similar experiment.
And KC2QIQ, because there is something here that I have to answer that.
Yeah, was your radiator always a high conductive material? By the way, 20 dB change is a 100-to-1 ratio. You'd have to change the effective capture area of an antenna by a 100-to-1 ratio to change its gain by 20 dB. So I don't believe that took place. Glenn, take your time. Start off and tell me what was the highest resistivity of any of the materials you may have used on the radiator function of that quarter wave ground plane. You got it, Glenn.
Get back to me, Dick, about a similar experiment.
Yeah, we'll see. By the way, Glenn, I know this may sound like an attack. It is not. You're enough of a scientist, and we've got a group of people here who think they're a scientist. We're trying to act like scientists. We're trying to get to the bottom of a confusing set of circumstances and measurements that start off by telling me the conductivity. Glenn, we're all getting educated by this, and so this is not an argument, although it may sound like it to somebody naive listening off to one side. This is not an argument. This is a discussion of measurement techniques of an antenna. And boy, that is always a controversial and difficult area. There's only a million ways a person who's very smart can make an erroneous measurement on an antenna range. There's a million ways you can do that. There are very few ways of doing it right. KC2QIQ, straighten this out here, Glenn. K2LIW, what was the conductivity of the material?
Smart people don't measure antennas.
Okay, here's what happened. I made measurements with basically three different types of materials, because you have to understand this information now is about a month old, and I'm just kind of like corrugating, you know, putting things together. And the GTEM is definitely the one question that I kind of knew myself right from the beginning that it was going to have some issues with the measurement. But here's the things that I definitely learned, okay, about quarter wave ground planes. So far, as I said, I understand this is not an attack, but this is something I found both inside the chamber and I've been looking at it now outside the chamber. And what I'm finding is, you hit the nail on the head when you said pattern is what's changing. Mounts. In other words, I started noticing this because now I'm looking back at a couple of mobile antennas that I made. In other words, I've made antennas where I've taken half-wave antennas, mobile mounted them with mag mounts, and put balun in the bottom, and all of a sudden, I have a great match, and all of a sudden, my antennas got ears, and I'm hearing things I didn't hear before. And I'm noticing also the other mounts where some of these screw mounts, the NMOs and the PL259 mounts, depending on which frequency that you're using them at and what kind of radiators you're attaching to the tops of these things, the patterns change wickedly. And here's an instance where the frequency range of the mount that I was plugging onto this plate was for a 3/8 screw mount with a bushing on the inside. Apparently, the frequency that this thing was set up for was nowhere near 449, and I'm sure that there was probably a frequency that it was designed for, but apparently it was completely mismatched, and something it did, because it was adjusting the... every time I changed the bushing, I was changing the length of the whip each time, and it, I mean, when I say adjusting the height of the whip to get it back to 50 ohms, I had a variation of like three different whips there, some copper, some aluminum, and I have to tell you, it was a couple of pieces of stainless steel there, but it wasn't the materials that were making the difference. It was the height and the bushing thickness to the bottom, and apparently it had to have been doing something where it was affecting the pattern of the antenna between the bushing and the length to give me the 50 ohms. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If your bushing was either very dense insulating material, or if it was a metallic object, and you change the size of the bushing and the spacing of the bushing to the ground plane, and this bushing is in contact with the radiator, the base of the radiator, you're changing the stray capacitance to ground at the bottom of the feed point. At first it sounds bad. That is a beautiful tuning technique. When you read that section I've got in the WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, MikeBravoAlpha.org, at the bottom of his webpage, you'll see where I talk about getting a perfect impedance match to any dipole, which really means any monopole, that you have ever constructed or ever construct again. I don't care if the dipole is part of a Yagi or if it's out in free space. I don't care if the monopole is mounted on garbage or on something really good. You can get a perfect impedance match if you can change the capacitance that you see at the point of feeding and the length of the radiator. As you change the length of the radiator, you're changing the resistive component. But along with that comes a reactive component. As you change the stray capacitance at the feed point, you now have control of the reactive component. Balance the two, and it's a very simple test, indicated in that article. You can always get a perfect impedance match. I think that's what you were doing, and that's perfectly beautiful, in my opinion. You don't have to measure, you don't have to maintain 50 ohms during every 16th of an inch, every few millimeters, as you come out of that connector. Some people think you do, and that is one approach. It is not a mandatory approach, in my opinion. Now, Mel has run into a few of these tests with his shootouts that his buddies have done in the parking lot at the Floyd Bennett Field, and I think he's going to tell us about some of those. K2KUI, go right ahead, Mel. K2RIW on the tech net.
And this is K2KEY. Well, you know, during these shootouts, they can become very confusing because you see so many different effects and you start to scratch your head. You don't know if they're coming and going. So one of them that I've seen on the laboratory so-called lab conditions or somewhat controlled conditions, a straightforward experiment. Now, basically, it was to have standard parts. Fake standard. In other words, what we used as the ground plane was a wave one. It was also done around 432. It was a one wavelength piece of copper sheet that was one wavelength by one wavelength. Then the dipole and the test antennas were all spaced approximately a quarter wavelength above the sheet. The material that was used was standard. I think, if I remember correctly, was copper rod, and what was its diameter? I think it was like 3/8, yeah, copper diameter tubing. That was the standard. And what we did was experiment. See if you put a dipole, single dipole on there, and then with another dipole in phase, see what the effect was. And you could see the definite effect was, I think, measured was around 7 dB over a dipole. Over a single element, I think there was a difference of about 7 dB when added the other element, Dick, in phase. In other words, two in phase half wave dipole, Dick. And it seems to stay with that experiment. Seems to be fairly accurate as a standard. Over.
I've heard of reports of this once before. There was a report of this in QEX magazine about 1 year ago. A guy who lives in the Alaska area was experimenting with two extremely close space. In his case, it was a two-element Yagi, driven element, and a director, I believe it was. I don't think it was a reflector, but it was extremely closely spaced. And when he got the two adjustments just right, it was a narrowband antenna, high circulating current, but his computer modeling told him he's going to get something like 6 decibels of gain out of that compared to one single dipole. And so he was about to go and build it in real world and report on the results. Well, a year later, we haven't heard those results. And I wrote him some letters at the time telling him, please let me know how it turns out. Is the computer model telling us the truth or not? And as I told you guys once before, Kent of the A5EJB is going to be giving a lecture at this year's Central States VHS Society, which takes place in the end of July. And he's going to be reporting on the fact that a number of people have had a little too much faith in computer modeling programs under certain conditions. And there are times when the computer program doesn't deserve that much faith. What it predicts and what you see in the real world sometimes differs. In your case, you were making real measurements in the real world. But, Glenn, let me ask you one more time. You did say you use stainless steel. Now, stainless steel is okay if it's large enough in diameter. Its resistivity doesn't come back and bite you. Where it really bit me was a 900 megacycle antenna where I had to make point contact, and I was looking for milliohms of repeatable contact with a gold-plated contact touching a stainless steel element of a radiating antenna, a 915 megs. And I was getting ridiculous, non-repeatable results. In your particular case, you've got this bushing with the set screw, and you were getting very good measurement, very good contact to the chunk of stainless steel, and hopefully the stainless steel wasn't super narrow. So I think most of the time you're using good connections to moderately good conducting materials. KC2QIQ for some further words on all this. And we're all getting a little smarter, Glenn. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
Can you copy me on the HT, or is the signal is it good enough to make it into the machine?
Signal is quite good. Go right ahead. And was that you giving me a trial transmission while I was talking at the end there?
No, but let me go ahead. The connections that I was using on the bottom was basically a copper piece that screwed into, it was threaded to 3/8 into the 3/8 setting. So that's copper on the bottom, and that has the little set screw inside of it that can be tightened down with an Allen key. The whips themselves were anything from aluminum pieces that I had, a little piece of aluminum that could fit inside this, and it could accommodate quite a few diameters inside the set screws that could mount it inside there. But certainly the larger diameters were certainly giving me the better performance, and that could very well be just because they were making better contact to the outer ring when I was tightening them down with the set screw. So that could be the answer to that one. And as I said, the overall difference in the diameter wasn't the big driver. And the materials, even the stainless steel, didn't seem to be a big driver. Although one could probably make the argument, you know, that, yeah, it was probably a little bit lower than the copper or the aluminum. But when you're looking at, you know, dB microvolt meter, in orders of magnitude, it just wasn't that big. But what was giving me the problem was the length of the whip and the bushings on the bottom that had some kind of an effect on what I'm... The only thing I could imagine it could be was the pattern that was coming off of the antenna. But oddly enough, I've been noticing that with other mounts, NMOs and the TL-259 mounts, that they all give different performance at different frequencies, and that they can affect... in some way, they have an effect on the pattern. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Previa for loop for Glenn.
Hello? Let me go back to an earlier statement you made, which I think is very pivotal. You did say that when you took the ground plane antenna, the quarter wave ground plane, on the wooden table, and when you raised it up a quarter of an inch or something like that, when you changed its altitude a small amount, you saw a significant change in the performance seen by the GTEM. I think you said that, and is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Okay, what was happening was every time I made a change to the bushing, what would happen is the tuning, in which I would measure the impedance to the antenna to see if it was still 50 ohms. I would change the bushing thickness that would raise the distance between the connector as it would go through the plate and and that fitting. Every time I would change that, the only way I could correct the 50 ohm match was by changing the length of the whip. So every time I would make a change to the whip was just because I was changing the bushing. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Did you change the bushing by sliding it vertically before locking down its set screw, or did you have a whole bunch of different diameter or different length bushings? How back to you, Glenn.
The diameters of the bushings for this particular type of connector, which has the type N on the bottom with screw threads into the plate, and what was happening was it was how far I was threading the 3/8 fitting into the top. So I was actually raising how far the whip was being able to screw in depth into the bottom piece. So what was happening was each time, yes, it was changing the height by maybe a quarter of an inch, but I would have to change the length of the whip to fix the match again by as much as 1 inch every time I would change the bushing height by maybe a quarter. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You also got another question on this, Dick.
Okay, yeah. No, recognize. I'm trying to picture the so-called bushing. I'm getting the impression now that the type N connector was the kind that is threaded. It intends to go through a chassis wall, and it's got a flange on one side, and you tighten a nut with a great big what do you call the damn thing? A lock.
The monkey wrench.
No. What do you put under the nut? It's a kind of a washer that's got teeth to it.
Spring washer.
Spring washer, locking washer. Okay. So you've got a locking washer under a nut as the connector goes through the panel, and it's got a flange. That's one kind of type N connector. You could buy another kind of type N connector where it doesn't have a flange, and the whole length of it is threaded, and you thread it into your piece of aluminum. You used one of those or the other. But one way or the other, your type N connector, you're going to connect the cable to the bottom of it, outside of the sheet metal, and where the center conductor and type N connector goes through, and it's threaded, you told us, and it goes through the sheet metal. On the top side, either you've got this lock washer and nut, or some kind of a bushing. And is the bushing made out of a metallic material, or is it a phenolic material, a insulating material? Does it thread onto the remaining threads of the type N connector sticking out above? What does the bushing mount to? I know it's got a set screw that allows you to adjust the length of the radiator and lock it down. But the bushing has to grab onto something. What does that bushing, what is it made out of? What does it grab onto? KT2QIQ, K2LIW.
Okay, what this is, how this works is that, as you mentioned before, the type N connector goes through the bulkhead or the ground plane itself, and there's a spring washer, star washer on the bottom that you tighten the nut down on and basically makes the electrical connection from the type N directly to the thread so that, that it's, you know, right to the plate. So that actually, that ground connection doesn't change. But what is changing is on the top is a bushing between the plate and this 3/8 thread, and the bushing is made out of Teflon material, and they're basically like washers, and what it does is it controls the height between the height and the width between the plate or the connector itself. The type N connector can thread it up through the top, and then basically there's the center pin is connected to this adjustment where you can tighten the 3/8 thread through the bottom, and what's happening is the Teflon is keeping the insulation between the ground and the whip itself. So by building it up in height, I'm getting the insulation higher away from the plate and from the outer ring of the type N connector. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, we're hearing for the first time that the bushing is made out of Teflon. Very, very, very valuable information. So the bushing is made out of Teflon. How is that Teflon mounted to either the ground plane sheet metal or to the type N connector is question number one. Are there separate screws holding the bushing down to make it steady? The bushing has a, I think you said, 3/8 set screw, which I presume comes off. The set screw, I presume, is parallel to the ground plane plate. I'm assuming it goes through a threaded hole in the Teflon, and that it in turn clamps down on the center conductor of the type N connector and the radiator, brings them together. The set screw makes them all one assembly. It is mechanically supporting the radiator. The set screw is connecting the radiator to the center conductor of the type N connector. And now, once again, what is holding the Teflon bushing to the ground plane? Are there separate screws doing that? Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, basically what's happening is the 3/8 thread is going into the type N connector. Now, that's basically what this little device is. It's a type N on one side, a 3/8 screw mount, you know, female, up on the top. So you can thread in a basically a 3/8 thread in the top. So basically what's happening is the bushing is what's separating this thread in 3/8 like a washer, that and keeping it away from the ground plane and the type N thread itself. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I heard the words, but I don't have the picture. But maybe Mel does. K2KEY, K2RIW, straighten me out, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. In other words, he's got a piece of Teflon as the bushing between, I guess, the plate and the vertical element, the vertical rod. In other words, he was using the piece of Teflon. Was it inserted into the bottom of the connector or into the connector, Glenn, over?
Well, this piece of Teflon has a shoulder and it also has a washer. So part of the washer itself sits between the type N connector and the 3/8 thread. So basically what it's doing is it's trying to keep a separation between the 3/8 thread and the ground of the connector. But the plate is a hard connection directly tightened down right around the type N part where the cable's plugged in on the other side of the plate.
Okay, so what do you use, a piece of tubing at that point to connect to the center pin and soldered it in place? Is that how it was constructed, over?
Exactly. So what's happening is I'm isolating the center pin to keep it away so I have something 3/8 that I can thread into at that point, and then that 3/8 fitting, I can slide whips in and out of it and tighten down the set screw. So that Teflon spacing is keeping the center conductor away from the ground plane on the outside of the connector.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Similar experiment. I saw something that came up in that experiment also. Instead of using the Teflon, what was used was a piece of rigid 50-ohm, 7/8 rigid 50-ohm coax. Now, that was, I was going to ask the question, why do you see such a discrepancy if you go from what Glenn just described and fed it the cable using a piece of 213 coax? And why do you see such a discrepancy if you went straight and just used the rigid piece of coax, 7/8 rigid coax, 50 ohm, and see such a discrepancy, Dick, over?
Oh, I think I have an answer for this one. Bear in mind now that I've been saying for a long time that the data we need to make quarter-wave ground plane antennas and half-wave dipole antennas, every possible diameter, every possible length of reasonable materials is beautifully graphed in the so-called Brown and Woodward set of curves that you can find in my little article at WA1MBA.org at the bottom of this page, or you can go to Chapter 4 of any of the issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4, Graph 4-3 and 4-4, I think it is. What Brown and Woodward did is they spent, in my opinion, a man year taking a great big ground plane with something like a Type N connector going through it and choose every possible diameter and every possible length of radiator and measure the real resistive impedance and the reactive impedance. The data is all there. When you read Brown and Woodward's data, the little paragraph as to how they made the measurements, they stated very emphatically that huge differences occurred in the way the bottom of the radiator came in the vicinity of the ground plane. Whether or not that section was very blunt and presented a lot of straight capacitance, or was tapered and presented very little straight capacitance, as the radiator came down to the semiconductor of the connector that's mounted to the ground plane. That section, Brown and Woodward said, is very sensitive. The mechanical layout there can make huge differences. It's not a showstopper. You could have any amount of straight capacitance there you want, and if you readjust the length of the radiator accordingly, you can bring it back to a very good standing wave ratio. That's what Kerr is saying. But that section that you're talking about near your bushing, and that height of the radiator, and how close it comes to the ground plane, and how much straight capacitance that occurs, that makes a huge difference. Brown and Woodward saw that in 1946 during the main year that they made all those measurements. And they had to do it before network analyzers exist. These poor guys had to do all that with a slotted line and a slide rule and a lot of elbow grease. Let me drop for a second. Now, you talked about a 3/8 set screw, and you said the 3/8 set screw goes through the Teflon, straight down, perpendicular to the ground plane, and touches the semiconductor of the Type N connector. I can sort of picture that, but now, where does the radiator go compared to that 3/8 set screw? At first I thought the set screw is coming into the side of the Teflon block, the Teflon bushing, and the set screw is parallel to the ground plane. You in your last transmission, two transmissions ago, said the 3/8 set screw goes vertically through the Teflon bushing and touches the semiconductor of the Type N connector. I'm having trouble now figuring out how you, through that 3/8 set screw, mount the radiator. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Okay, now I see what the question is. What's happening is the whip itself has a 3/8 thread on the bottom. It's not the set screw. The set screw is a very, very small screw. It's like a 440 screw that actually tightens the whip to the center of this little piece. So the piece that the whip slides into is really just a 3/8 thread on the, think of it as a 3/8 screw, and it's drilled out on the top, and there's a little 90-degree perpendicular hole opening that's threaded for the set screw to go into a 3/8 thread, so you can tighten the whip in the center of this 3/8 thread, so you can tighten down the whip inside of that. But the 3/8 is really just the thread that threads into the mount on the bottom.
Now it's a lot more clear. Okay. And you said you've made multiple changes to the bushing, and the bushing is made out of Teflon. Does that mean you've got multiple Teflon bushings of various diameters or height or whatever? And how is the bushing held down to the ground plane? Is there a 5/8 24 thread on the inside of the bushing that picks up the 5/8 24 thread on the outside of the Type N connector? That's one approach. Or the bushing itself, by some means, is screwed down to the ground plane. What holds the bushing to the ground plane vicinity? Back to you, Glenn.
Well, see, the problem comes in with the 3/8 thread. When the Type N connector comes through, it's basically a pre-made piece for antennas of much lower frequency, where what they do is they have the 3/8 thread coming out the other side, the female thread coming out. It's like a nut that comes out of the other side. One side has got the Type N connector on it. The other side has got basically the 3/8 female, like a nut, that you're screwing this into. Now, unfortunately, the way that this thing mounts, there's a shoulder on this washer where the 3/8 thread part goes into the Type N connector, and what's happening is it's got a shoulder on it and a thickness. And what I had to do was keep on adding more and more thick thickness to raise the height of the thread as it went in, to basically insulate it away from the ground plane. That was the kind of problem that I was having, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QXU.
Okay, I'm getting the picture. So you had a mechanism by which you can change the amount of stray capacitance between the center pin of the type N connector and this whole mounting arrangement of the set screw on the 3/8 threaded thing that the whip really plugged into. And I presume what the whip did now is you made different diameters of whip, but you machined the bottom of the whip so it would always plug into the top of the 3/8 screw, set screw, with its 440 set screw off to one side. That's what I think you were doing. So, but by one means or another, I think you can change the stray capacitance between the base assembly that we just described, the metallic base assembly, and the ground plane. By various techniques there, you can change length of radiator and the amount of that stray capacitance, which is good. That's a beautiful tuning technique, if I understand it correctly. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
That's basically the gist of it, Dick. But what I was noticing, as opposed to the half-wave dipole, as opposed to the loop antenna, and everything else, was that even with a 50-ohm match, there's a lot of ways where, depending on that bushing and the type of mount that a quarter-wave antenna is going into, like, let's say, you know, even in real life, if you have an NMO mount or you have a PL-259 mount, I think that when you buy an antenna, it has to be matched to that mount when you're putting it down there, because if you just take a plain old NMO mount and a plain old PL-259 mount and you just start randomly plugging antennas into it, I think the types of patterns that are going to come off these antennas is going to be all over the place. But that's just what I've been seeing. I don't have really hard data to prove it other than partial data right now. But we're half-wave dipole center fed, loop antennas. You can position them, put them up, and the performance is very standard. What I'm seeing in some of these mounts is that where they're mounted close to the base, and, you know, you can tune it for 50 ohms, but you may not be getting the pattern that you're expecting. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay. Whether you've got a NMO mount, a UHF, a type N, or whatever mount, in any case, you've got a connector on the, let's call it the bottom side of the ground plane, which picks up your feed line, and hopefully it is a 50-ohm connector. Top of the ground plane, various mechanical arrangements exist, which will give you mechanical coupling to the radiator that's connected to that center pin. And those various methods of mounting will change the stray capacitance between the base of the radiator and the ground plane. And that's a beautiful tuning arrangement if you're smart enough to use it in your favor. As you use that tuning arrangement, whether there's a coil in there because it's a 5/8 wave radiator and there's an impedance matching network in the base which steps up the impedance to the 1,000 ohms that you get at the base of a 5/8 radiator or a half-wave radiator, or whether or not there is an impedance matching device and you're making direct contact to the quarter-wave radiator, yes, there is a difference in pattern between half-wave and quarter-wave. It's not huge, but there is a difference in pattern. But the inch or so of change in height of an NMO with a matching arrangement or these bushings that you're describing, we're talking about changes of about an inch, and a wavelength on the 440 megacycles is 27 inches. We're talking about a 27th of a wavelength of change in altitude in that area. That cannot make any change in the radiated pattern. Now, whether or not the ground plane is not big enough, whether or not the ground plane is acting as a less than perfect counterpoise, whether or not there's radiated signal going down the outside of the transmission line that's feeding the bottom of the ground plane, common sense would lead you to believe that ground plane is a great big stopper of RF and no RF is going to flow around it and flow down the outside of the coax cable. Well, that ain't true. If the ground plane is a full wavelength in diameter, a full half wavelength in radius electronically, it will be a very good RF shield. Any other dimension, not so good. Or an infinite size is very good. Other than that, there's going to be some radiated signal on the cable. The radiated signal on the cable can change repeater timeout. The radiated signal on your cable can change your radiated pattern substantially. But except for that radiated pattern from the signal, which could have confused the daylights out of GTAP, this change of altitude of an NMO versus other mounting techniques, and we're talking about an inch or two, can that make a big change in the pattern? I say no. It doesn't have the real estate to do it. Until your radiating structure and its counterpoise changes a substantial fraction of a wavelength, you don't have the wherewithal to change the radiated pattern. Now, whether or not the coax cable is hot can make a huge difference. But other than hot coax cable, there isn't enough change in real estate of radiating system to make a substantial change in the pattern. That, what I believe to be a truth, tells me that the measurement changes that you saw of some number of decibels of dBMV in the GTEM may not be real. That's my belief, Glenn, and it's going to take a little more research to find out. KC2QIQ, and maybe we should let you go. We've held you long enough. Thank you for all the info. KC2LIW.
Got one more question, KC2KEY.
One more comment.
Glenn first, and then Mel in that order. Glenn, you pass it over to Mel when you're through.
I think the effect that I'm talking about, Dick, is along these lines. I mean, this may not be the exact model of it, but I think what it kind of is like this. If you have, let's say, a magnetic mount antenna that's flat on the car, and you have it tuned for 50 ohms, you have a good match, and you're getting very, very good signal performance at the antenna, and the propagation is just the way that you like it. Now, if you were to take a box and sit it between the antenna, and then you just raise the antenna up a few inches up off of the, and you isolate that magnetic mount from the, basically from the body of the car, and now you take an antenna tuner and retune the bottom of it, yes, you can get the 50 ohm match back again, but I don't think the radiation pattern is going to be what you would expect. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, you're absolutely right. The base of a mag mount has an extremely skinny piece of plastic that's trying to stop you from scratching the paint on your car. That skinny piece of plastic is trying to represent an extremely large coupling capacitor between the base of the mag mount and the sheet metal of your car. It is hoping to be a big enough capacitor so that the capacitive reactance is, let me pick a number, 1 ohm of capacitive reactance on a 50 ohm system. Therefore, the base of the mag mount thinks it is electronically screwed into the sheet metal of that car. You raise that mag mount 1 inch, and that 1,000 picofarad capacitor becomes a 20 picofarad capacitor, instead of picking numbers out of the air. All of a sudden, your counterpoise, your base plate on your mag mount is now floating in air. Now your transmission line is hot, and you've got to do some real hard work to rematch that thing. Now your new radiating system is a floating mag mount, a radiator, and a hot piece of coax cable. That's a very different antenna. That's my belief in what happened. Without a doubt, I agree you're going to get a huge change when you do that spacing that you discovered with the cardboard box. And that's my explanation. Let's see what Mel has to say about all this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
What I really am questioning now, you know, you brought up this subject at this point where you said like a mag mount and all. What I'm going to question now, if you're feeding a mag mount, really, is it going to make a difference? I mean, in the experiment, you see a difference between 7/8 rigid coax and regular 213. Are you going to say to me that the coax becomes a factor, that you're going to have a different result with 7/8 rigid coax versus regular 213, Dick? Over.
Hold on now, Glenn. I didn't say that. I mean, Mel. He was taking a mag mount, which ordinarily is really magnetically coupled to the sheet metal in the center of the roof of his automobile. That's the ideal place to put a mag mount. And that very thin piece of plastic under there that's protecting the paint has a lot of magnet and sheet metal above and all the sheet metal of the car below and 2,000ths of an inch of thickness of plastic. That is a large UHF, VHF capacitor, such that the capacitive reactance there is very small, therefore that mag mount is electronically almost part of the sheet metal of your car. It's almost as if you put an MNO connector through the sheet metal and screwed it down to your car and damaged the car itself, put a permanent hole in the sheet metal. It's almost as if you did that electronically. If you now take that mag, and by the way, that's a beautiful ground plane when you do that for the radiator to work against. You're now using all the sheet metal of the car as a counterpoise. If I take that mag mount, as Glenn just described, and put a cardboard box under it of, let's say, 1 inch of thickness, so the mag mount is now floating in air, and I rebalance everything so it doesn't fall over, all of a sudden, my quarter wave ground plane does not have a counterpoise. It's got that little square of magnetic material at the bottom, which is about 3 inches square. That's nowhere near the right amount of counterpoise, so let's say 2 meters or 440. It's now floating. Therefore, the transmission line going into the mag mount, which is usually RG58 or RG223, it's a quarter-inch diameter transmission line. That transmission line is now hot. And because the transmission line is radiating almost as much as the real radiator, you've now got a very different pattern. And if you flipped over from using that transmission line, the way it's supplied by the mag mount manufacturer, he's giving you RG58 or RG223. If you suddenly made that transmission line the RG213 or 7/8 inch coax, you're going to change things a little bit, but you still got a hot transmission line because the antenna floating on that cardboard box no longer has its counterpoise. It's got to pump electrons from somewhere. If it ain't pumping them from the sheet metal of your car, because you've isolated your antenna from the sheet metal of your car, it's going to pump them from your coax cable, your coax repeater.
Time out.
Your coax cable is now hot. I don't give a darn what diameter it is, unless you make it a foot in diameter and now it becomes a brand new ground plane. You're going to have a hot coax. That's my belief, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, I think now you hit something now I see. I couldn't figure out this phenomenon. I was fooled with a mag mount. I have a car, my Chevy, that has that vinyl top over metal. The vinyl top is about, I don't know how, maybe it's a 16th or maybe, I don't know, maybe an 1/8 of an inch thick, the vinyl top. I was going crazy saying, why does that mag mount behave so much different when it's put on the top of the car versus put on, like, say, the trunk of the car? I could not come up. I said it has to be the difference in material somewhere around. I didn't know what the heck to blame it on. And I see now, you think you may have the answer, Dick. It's what's under it, the thickness. I'm doing the same thing. I'm making, like you say, that thin piece of plastic now. I'm actually making it thicker, that insulating piece of plastic that, like you say, keeps the car from getting scratched. I'm moving it thicker. I'm making it thicker. I think that is what exactly is confirming this, Dick, over.
Beautiful. And that thicker piece of plastic now of the vinyl top of your car, plus the real piece of plastic that's under the mag mount itself, those two combined probably cut down your base capacitance between the mag mount and the sheet metal of your car, probably cut it down by 4-1. The capacitor that's there when you go directly between the thin piece of plastic on the bottom of the mag mount, directly to the paint of the sheet metal of a car, that capacitor is marginal. It's just barely big enough on 2 meters. And when you tripled or doubled or quadrupled that thickness because of the vinyl top of your car, which is a lot thicker piece of plastic because it's got to survive ultraviolet and snow and ice and everything else. It's a lot more than that skinny piece of plastic that's on the mag mount. You now went from, let me pick a number, a couple of ohms of capacitive reactant in that area to all of a sudden a lot of ohms of capacitive reactant. Now your mag mount is RF-wise almost floating. Therefore, your transmission line is hot. Therefore, your impedance match has gone down the tube, and all of a sudden the system is very different. And the hotness of the transmission line is the part that should make you a little bit unhappy if you were running high power. You are a QRP person, so that's not much of a problem. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, now I confirmed something. That's why I gave up on a mag mount on the car. And I went and I put on this, I got this antenna that I remember I mentioned once described. that they were using it on commercial, or I should say military vehicles, that they don't use mag mounts and all. They use an antenna that actually goes onto a solid mount on the side of a car or onto a rear bumper, made by Dodge. What the hell? Dilbert Dodge or somebody. I forgot. It's a stainless steel antenna. Very fancy antenna for 432. And it works marvelous, whereas the mag mount was marginal. And I said, what the heck magic have they got in this antenna? But I think it wasn't that. It was my car that I'm using, the mag mount on the car, as you described it, over.
Yeah, I think you discovered a lot here. And that extra thickness of your vinyl gave you a floating mag mount. On top of that, the extra spacing means the magnet didn't come as close to the sheet metal. I'll bet you that car was a lot easier to blow off the roof when you hit a branch of a tree. Is that true?
No, the magnet was powerful enough to hold. No, it didn't come off. Never had anything, you know, to worry about that. Of course, you take any of them if you're going to hit a solid object, you know, like a low, you know, the garage door or something coming down, and you try to sneak through, you'll knock it over. But I never had it, you know, fall over from just normal driving or anything, Dick, because it still had enough magnetic, you know, pull. But like I say, I never saw the performance out of it, and I tried. I said, what am I doing? Why is this not working on this car? And now you put two and two together. It had to be the thickness of the vinyl, over.
I think we're all getting a little smarter here. Now, where I need your guys' help is that...
Bring it this out.
Where I need your guys' help is on... how do I stop the water from sneaking down that RG-58 or RG-223 cable, which goes through the rubber seal on the rear door on the driver's side of my car, and the water, on a really heavy rainy day, the water runs down that cable and drips onto the rug in the back of my car. How do I stop that from happening? Has anybody got a great solution to that one? If so, give me your call letters right now, and I'll pay you well. K2RIW.
KC2, QIQ.
There's the man with the answer. Go ahead, Glenn.
Being a person who uses mag mounts all the time and finding all different ways to use them, one of the tricks that I've used is I run the cable length down the side of the door and then basically either try to loop it underneath the bottom or one of the sides. And then we just look at the spacing near the side of the door. And basically the lower you go on the door, the less critical it is to rain dropping in the top. As long as you can dress the wire down the side of the door and allow it to come in from a lower level. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Exactly, Dick. As long as you make a loop.
Okay. Do you tape the wire down so that it stays in that metal channel on the outside of the rubber seal of the door, and you don't bridge with the coax cable, the rubber seal, until it's down at a low point where the water would run out instead of run in? So do you use, what do they call that now? That gluey gray tape. Mine's gone blank. You know what I mean. What do they call that kind of tape? You know, you got the tape. That's the right word. Give that man a cigar. Duct tape. So, did you use some kind of duct tape light to make the cable stay in the right spot, or is your cable trained, Glenn? Go ahead.
Oh, I love to train my cables, Dick. And how I do it is I'll make sure it's a door that I'm not using. In other words, if you're entering through the driver's side, either use the door behind you as one of the rear passenger doors, or go onto the other side of the car. And what you can do is basically place the antenna on the roof, drape the wire down, and then take that door and kind of dress the wire down around the outside and figure out the relative length. Then pull the magnetic mount off and basically close the door around the wire very, very carefully, making sure you're not crushing it, and just close the door and then just dress the wire back up again and then place the magnetic mount antenna in place to take up all the slack so that the wire doesn't flap around on the side of the car.
Makes a lot of sense. And it's pretty dumb that I haven't realized that a year ago. I poured an awful lot of water under the roof, under the floor of my car, and had to go through a drying out procedure on two or three occasions. I should have realized this one earlier. Fantastic. Okay. You guys got the right idea. Why didn't I think of that? Alrighty. I'm a little worried though, Glenn, when you, I think you told me earlier that as you raise or lower the antenna in the GTEM, you would see a different amount of apparent signal into the G10. And because the E field at the tip of a quarter wave ground plane is a very high voltage, and as you bring that tip, even though it may have been 6 inches or a foot away, as you bring it closer or further away from the strip line that goes down the center of the GTEM, it changes the coupling coefficient of the GTEM, changes the amount of signal the GTEM picks up. That could have been some of that 10 or 20 dB microvolt differences you saw, and therefore that may not be real gain change. So under the circumstances you're describing, to make a quarter of a decibel of change in the gain of the antenna without having a hot transmission line would be very, very difficult to do. And 10 or 20 decibels of change is many orders of magnitude beyond which I think the laws of physics will let you do in the real world of signals radiated into free space. A signal radiated into the semiconductor of a GTEM, yeah, you'll see it. It may not be real. That's my belief in this particular situation, Glenn. That GTEM was not intended as an antenna range. It's intended to make a very uniform E-field for electromagnetic compatibility testing. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, I think what's happening here, though, Dick, too, is that the antenna being larger wasn't giving me more signal per se. What was really happening was that because of the bushing size, I had to correct the length in order to correct the match to back to 50 ohms again. And it was because of these different bushing sizes. But what really, I think the key thing, if there's something to take out of this whole thing that I learned in the GTEM chamber, was that if you measure the height of the antenna, in other words, if you use just even the simple quarter wave formula, you know, 234 divided by frequency in megahertz, and you're going to get a length in feet multiplied by 12, and you got the length in inches. So if you have a known number of inches that you're expecting to see the antenna off the ground plane for a quarter wave at the frequency that you're expecting for 50 ohm match, you should be pretty darn close to that. If you start seeing that you're too short or you're too tall, something else is going on, and chances are, even though you are getting a 50 ohm match because of cutting the length, you may not be getting the pattern that you're expecting. H2RIW, KC2QIQ.
But if my counterpoise, my ground plane, is not hot, if it's big enough and properly mounted such that there isn't RF energy crawling onto the ground plane and onto the transmission line, if your ground plane is not hot, and you're talking about less than an inch of change of either the base or the top or the total length or whatever of the quarter wave radiator, an inch of change, a 27th of a wavelength change, cannot change the pattern. It takes real estate to generate pattern. You didn't change the real estate. Therefore, you can't change the pattern. If you didn't change the pattern, you can't change the measured gain, as long as you didn't change the efficiency. And I believe your antenna is efficient. So you can see why I'm saying that what you saw in the GTEM, I'm worried that some of it is not real, Glenn. Go ahead.
Well, I kind of think it is, Dick. And I'll tell you another thing that kind of backs up what I'm saying here is quite a few years ago, I built an antenna right out of the AWRL handbook. And it was basically taking a CB antenna on a CB form and recutting the antenna to, I think the dimensions at the time were 39 inches, and you rewound the coil underneath the bottom. And with the CB mount, you could basically match this thing to something very, very close to 50 ohms, and it would tune right for 2 meters, and it would work very, very well in terms of match. But anybody who ever built that antenna and tried to use it on their car, it was awful. It was a terrible antenna. The pattern that came off this thing was horrible. And then you could probably just use a regular quarter wave, you know, commercially built ground plane, put it on the car, and it would be fantastic by comparison. And I think what I've learned over time is that there's spacing issues between the ground plane and the match, where you could get a good match where it seems like it's, you know, you're measuring the end of the cable and you're seeing 50 ohms, but, you know, in reality what's happening is you're not getting the correct mechanism of match and the correct capacitance down to the chassis to support the correct counterpoise and ground plane, and what you're really getting is a really, really, you're getting a good match, but like you're saying, either the cable is hot or something else is going on, and the pattern is not what you would expect.
In that CB antenna that you converted for 2 meter operation, what was the length of that radiator, Glenn? And how was the base of the antenna connected either capacitively or